Akatra Foundation presents the Akatra Dialogue, an exploration of the world's greatest thinkers and ideas. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI. Welcome back. So today we're doing a deep dive based on a listener request for the author Luke Sante. Initially, they were thinking about a book called I Have Some Questions for You.
Right. We should probably clear that up straight away. Great book, but that one's actually by Rebecca Mackay. Luke Sante didn't write it.
Exactly. So we adjusted. Instead of focusing on a book he didn't write, we thought, let's go deeper. Let's look at Sante himself, his whole body of work, especially his foundational text, Low Life.
Yeah, and that feels like the right move.
Mm-hmm.
Because Luke Sante, born 1954, Belgian-American, you can call him a writer, critic, historian, sure.
Okay.
But those labels feel a bit clean.
A bit neat, maybe.
Exactly. He's really more of a cultural archaeologist. Okay. Someone even called him a psychic medium for cities' ghosts.
Wow, okay. That paints a picture. And why should you, listening now, care about this? Why does his story matter today?
Because he fundamentally changed how we think about history. We're taught history is, you know, the big monuments, the famous names, the official stories.
The stuff carved in stone.
Right. But yeah. Sante, he just rejects that. He argues the real history, the authentic stuff, isn't in the monuments. It's in the stains.
The stains, meaning?
Meaning the forgotten bits,
mm-hmm.
the alleyways, the police records, the lives nobody bothered to write down. You know, the con artists, the immigrants just trying to survive, the kids on the street.
So he's digging through the historical trash heap, essentially, finding the messy first draft that got thrown out.
Precisely. Reading Sante is like doing an excavation. So how did he get this unique perspective? We need to go back chronologically to the beginning.
Okay, where does his story start?
He was born in Bavieres, Belgium, 1954. It was a working-class industrial town. But the really key event, the thing that shaped him profoundly, was his family moving to the U.S. early 1960s.
Emigration. And that's always a huge upheaval.
Huge. And crucially, they weren't chasing some idealized American dream. They came as economic refugees. That's his term.
Ah, okay. That's a very different starting point. Not idealism, but necessity.
Yeah.
How did that affect him, sort of, internally?
It made him an outsider.
Okay.
Permanently. He said it forced him to become this really meticulous observer, watching American culture, trying to figure out the codes, you know?
So he got that outsider's critical eye, but also learned the language, the culture, from the inside. Kind of the best of both worlds for a critic.
Absolutely. And these early influences were fascinatingly mixed. On one side, you have this love for the texture of old, decaying buildings.
Okay.
And on the other, punk rock. The raw energy, the anti-establishment vibe.
That's quite a combination. Old buildings and punk rock.
And French symbolist poetry, too. He was deeply into that. So you get this blend. The grit of the street, the atmosphere of poetry, and the analytical eye of someone looking at, say, an old police file.
Which leads us nicely into his rather unconventional path forward. He did go to Columbia University for a bit in the 70s.
Briefly, yeah. But he found it stifling. That academic world wasn't for him, so he dropped out.
And his real education became?
The city itself. He was a serious autodidact. His classrooms were places like the St. Mark's Bookshop, music venues like CBGB, the stacks of the New York Public Library. He was right there in the thick of that bankrupt, dangerous, but incredibly creative downtown New York scene of the 70s and 80s.
Living the history he'd later write about.
Pretty much. But then there's this interesting twist for his career breakthrough. He ends up working in the mailroom.
The mailroom.
At the New York Review of Books. Can you imagine?
Yeah.
The punk-influenced autodidact learning the ropes inside one of the most highbrow literary journals around.
That's amazing. Talk about a backdoor entry.
It really was. And it gave him this incredible, rigorous editorial discipline. That kind of apprenticeship, even in the mailroom, was crucial for what came next.
Which was Low Life. 1991. And this wasn't just knocked out overnight, was it?
Oh, God, no. This was like a decade. A decade of obsessive, solitary work, digging through archives.
And the book itself.
It just landed like a bomb. Utterly original. A dense, almost dreamlike history of New York's underworld, 1840 to 1919. It wasn't linear, wasn't academic in the usual sense. It was visceral.
And people responded.
Big time. Critics loved it. It basically defined his unique voice overnight. Made him a major figure.
And his later work continued in that vein.
Yeah, largely. The Factory of Facts is this amazing memoir about his Belgian childhood, very much using that same kind of fragmented archaeological approach to his own past. The Other Paris applies the Low Life method to, well, Paris, And he had a long, distinguished teaching career, too, at Bard College.
Teaching, writing, and history of photography, right?
Mm-hmm. And what's really fascinating about his later years, and it kind of brings everything full circle, is how he applied this whole philosophy to himself.
How so?
Well, his honesty about his struggles with depression, for one, and then his public announcement in 2021 about his gender transition, it feels so aligned with his lifelong themes of identity being fluid, something constructed, something maybe even revised.
Wow. So he didn't just write about identity as a fluid concept. He lived it publicly, treating his own life almost like one of his texts.
Exactly. It's his profound intellectual and personal honesty. If his whole thing is bearing witness to the messy truth in the margins, he turned that lens right back on himself.
Okay, so let's really unpack that core philosophy then. If official history is propaganda, what's his alternative? What's driving him?
At its heart, it's skeptical, deeply skeptical of power, and it's democratic. He truly believes the important stories are with the people who don't usually get a voice. There's an almost anarchic quality to it. Let's blow up the official story and see what's really underneath.
And this connects to that key analogy, the rag picker, which you got from Walter Benjamin.
Yes, the rag picker is absolutely central. You have to understand this. Benjamin wrote about the Parisian rag picker, someone literally sorting through garbage, finding value in discarded things. Sante does that intellectually.
He's sifting through the historical refuse.
Right. The forgotten police files, the sensationalist old tabloid clippings, anonymous photographs that nobody valued at the time. He's looking in history's dustbin.
So it's not about reading the established historians. It's about finding the primary source material that everyone else ignored or threw out.
Exactly. And what does this reveal? It reveals the city as a palimpsest.
Okay, explain palimpsest.
It's an old manuscript page where the original text was scraped off so it could be reused, but faint traces of the first writing still remain underneath.
I see. So the modern city is like that. The glossy new surface is written over the messy older stories, but if you look closely,
you can still see the ghosts, the faint outlines of what was there before. The marginalized lives, the chaotic energy, it's still faintly visible beneath the surface if you know how to look. That's his method in a nutshell.
And the motivation behind it all, is it just intellectual curiosity?
No, I think it's deeper than that. It feels like a moral imperative for him to bear witness for the forgotten. It's like he's seeking historical justice.
Giving dignity back to people history erased. The Bowery toughs, the immigrant workers.
Precisely. To say, your lives mattered. Your story is part of the real story.
And you mentioned he applies this analytical approach even to his own struggles, like the immense effort for low life or dealing with depression.
Yeah, that decade working on low life, that was pure conviction, no guarantee anyone would care. And his writing about depression, it's analytical, honest. He treats his own experiences almost like historical evidence to be examined.
Turning failure or struggle into material.
That's a kind of intellectual persistence, isn't it? Taking the difficult stuff and deconstructing it, finding meaning in it, rather than just being overwhelmed by it.
Okay, this is fascinating. Let's pinpoint three moments, three key turning points that really shifted his life's direction.
Right, the pivots. The first one we've touched on, but it's fundamental. Immigration to the United States around 1960.
This wasn't just moving house. It created his whole way of seeing, that outsider superpower you mentioned.
Exactly. It forced that critical distance. He was in American culture, but never fully of it in that unthinking way. He always saw the seams, the construction of it all.
Okay, turning point number one, displacement forging perspective. What's number two?
Number two has to be dropping out of Columbia University in the early 70s.
This was his conscious no to the established path.
A very conscious no. He chose self-education. He chose the street, the library, the music clubs. He was basically saying, my knowledge will come from direct experience, from the messy reality, not just from sanctioned institutions. It cemented his commitment to the counterculture, to finding knowledge his own way.
All right. And the third major turning point.
That would be the publication of Low Life in 1991.
The moment his weird obsessive method was validated.
Totally validated. It proved there was an audience, a big audience, hungry for history, told this way through fragments, through atmosphere, through the lives of the forgotten. It legitimized everything he'd been working towards in isolation.
It proved the rag picker's finds were treasures.
Beautifully put. It gave him the freedom to keep digging in those overlooked corners for the rest of his career.
So, thinking about his journey, what are the big human lessons here for you listening? Especially if you've ever felt like you didn't quite fit in.
Well, that's the first big one, isn't it? That feeling of being an outsider, of not belonging. Sante's life shows us that's not a deficit. It's actually a source of strength.
A unique perspective. Clarity.
Exactly. That critical distance lets you see things the insiders might miss because they're too comfortable, too invested in the status quo.
And his path also says something powerful about learning, doesn't it? Especially now.
Oh, absolutely. Embrace autodidacticism. His life is a testament to the idea that real education isn't just about degrees. It's driven by passion, by obsession, getting your hands dirty, engaging directly with the world. That's where the deepest learning often happens.
Don't just wait to be taught. Go find the knowledge yourself.
Right. And finally, thinking about his whole life, including his later evolution, it really speaks to identity.
That it's not fixed.
Not at all. His journey suggests identity is something we construct, maybe perform. He used phrases like a performance, a dream, a fiction. It implies we have agency. We can revise the script of who we are.
Which is ultimately incredibly liberating, right? The idea that you're not stuck with one version of yourself.
Hugely liberating. And, you know, his whole approach, that skepticism towards grand narratives, that focus on digging up primary sources, it feels like such a vital skill for us right now.
In an age of competing official stories and endless information.
We need that Sante method. Don't just believe the headline. Look for the residue. Look for the evidence that doesn't fit the neat story.
Okay, let's boil this down. What are the three essential takeaways from Lixante's life and work?
All right, three key insights. First, an emotional one. The feeling of being an outsider isn't a weakness. It's a lens. Lixante's entire life was shaped by his family's immigration. He learned to love the cracks, the margins, the forgotten people, because he saw himself in them. His work teaches us that the deepest empathy often comes from the perspective of the person on the outside looking in.
Powerful. Okay, what's the intellectual insight?
History's a crime scene. Seriously. Official records tell you what the powerful want you to believe, but the real story, the truth is, in the evidence they left behind, maybe tried to cover up. He taught us that history isn't a clean, linear story. It's a chaotic, violent, and beautiful collage, and you can only understand it by piecing together the fragments that everyone else threw away.
Yeah.
Like a detective.
History as detective work. Got it. And the universal insight, the practical takeaway.
Look for the residue. Lixante's work is a powerful call to look down, to look closer. The real story is in what's left behind. The faded ghost sign on a brick wall, the unusual curve of a street, the scuff marks on a floorboard. By learning to see this residue, we connect more deeply to the places we live and to the vast, invisible human story of which we are all a part. Pay attention to the details.
Wow. Look for the stains, listen to the ghosts, find the residue, an incredible legacy from someone who started as an outsider.
Yeah. He proves the ghosts often have the most interesting tales to tell.
They really do. Fantastic stuff. Join us next time for a new episode featuring another world-renowned individual, a new book, and a new idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.